This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Those jeans you're wearing, that shirt, where were they made? The labels on the waistband or inside the collar really don't tell you very much at all. Journalist Rachel Louise Snyder says you can, for example, use a label that says made in Bangladesh, even if the shirt is sitting on a hanger at a factory in China. If the back and front panels of the shirt and the sleeves were sewn in Bangladesh, then shipped off to China to have the cuffs, collars, and finishing done, you can circumvent the fact that China has perhaps used up all of its quota. And under current trade law, you'll be allowed to use the Made in Bangladesh label. Rachel Louise Snyder will also tell you the labels on our clothing don't say anything about all the people who toil to get us into a pair of jeans, from the people who grow the cotton and the people who pick the cotton that's made into denim to the people who design our jeans and those who piece them together. Rachel Louise Snyder tells all these stories and more in her book Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade. She joins us this afternoon to tell us some of what she learned over the course of reporting and writing Fugitive Denim. Rachel Louise Snyder, our guest, has written for many publications. She's also a regular contributor to public radio, including the programs All Things Considered, This American Life, and Marketplace. Her book, Fugitive Denim, is published by W.W. Norton. Rachel, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure to talk with you. Those rules, who writes them?
Yeah. I'm tempted to make a joke here, really, because they do seem ridiculous. They're negotiated sort of country by country, but they get rewritten with different administrations in different countries, and they've come to be that way over the course of decades. It isn't as if they set out and sort of wrote them that way. It's just that they've kind of happened.
Yeah. Are they fair?
Well, that's a big question. We only have an hour, right?
Right.
I think every time a rule gets rewritten, it is an attempt to make the system fair. But, the fairness doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. So, you can look at different economies and different living conditions, and so, in various countries. And so the concept of fairness gets a little bit muddy when you're saying, well, is this fair to the U.S. cotton farmers, and is it also fair to the African cotton farmers? Their standards of fairness, I think, are very different for those two worlds.
Yeah. What led you to this story?
Well, I moved from Chicago to Cambodia 4.5 years ago for a little adventure and whatnot, and I learned that Cambodia was the only developing country in the world that had tried out this, they'd written a trade deal with the U.S. under the Clinton administration where they were trying out a system that would eradicate sweatshops in exchange for trade incentives, and that trade agreement was abolished when they joined the WTO as part of the requirements for joining the WTO. And it just seemed fascinating on so many levels to me to have, we just assume. I mean, I've heard on sitcoms in America, a joke about a sweatshop, and it's almost always Cambodia. I don't know why Cambodia. And I just want to say to the people who are writing these shows, like, that's the one country, the one developing country that does not have sweatshops and has actively tried to eradicate them. And it just seemed really fertile ground for a journalist. I started to write about it a lot and really look at it, and the issue was much bigger than just Cambodia's own borders.
Mm. The working conditions, we're all aware of sweatshops now. As you mentioned, they show up as a subject in sitcoms, but have the working conditions improved with the attention that's been focused on the garment and shoe industry?
I would say, in general, there is an awareness and there has been improvement. It's not a perfect system, of course. Everybody knows that. I mean, child labor was found last fall in India, and Jordan has had problems with it that have been publicized in the last year. But I do think that there are, I do think that a lot of the larger brands, the Gaps, the Levi's, the ones that are common names, are actively doing a lot of work to try to eradicate the problems in their factories around the world. So there has definitely been progress made since the issue came to light in the mid-90s, but it certainly has a long way to go.
Yeah. The first people we meet in Fugitive Denim are Rogan Gregory and Scott Hahn, and they're in the fashion business. Tell us about these two fellows.
Well, Rogan and Scott met about 10 years ago, and they live in New York. They are they're most known, I think, because they're the designers for Eden, which is the brand that Bono from U2 and his wife have. But they, in fact, have two other brands themselves, Loom State and one called Rogan, named, obviously, for the designer. And they do really high-end fashion, but with Loom State, for example, they use only 100% organic cotton in whatever they make. And with Eden, they try to use as much organic cotton as they can find. It's actually getting more and more difficult to find it because the demand is increasing each year by so much. But they also pay their factory workers, they have very good working conditions, and they pay their factory workers over $300 a month, which is an astounding figure for a factory worker in almost any developing country.
Hmm. What led Bono into the blue jean business?
Yeah. Well, presumably he wears them a lot, right?
So it makes sense. Who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. It's really more of his wife's company. He lends his name for a certain amount of social capital, I think, which is a smart marketing idea. But for him, you know, everybody, I'm sure most of your listeners have heard him speak or at least heard little snippets on the news, and he's always saying things like, you know, trade, not aid. And so he wanted to show the world, really, basically, that you could have sweatshop-free conditions, that you could have garments that were beautiful and well-made and, you know, not necessarily made in China. Their stuff is not made in China. It's mostly made in Africa. And he wanted to sort of help lift these communities out of poverty rather than just throwing more money at them, which has been the development model for a good number of years now.
Hmm. One of the things that Scott Hahn, I think it was Scott, told you was that the garment industry is like an ecosystem.
Yeah, that I thought that was a really apt metaphor, and what he meant by that was just this sort of interconnectedness that everybody has. So, you know, you look at the brand, take the Gap, for example, based in San Francisco. They hire somebody in Hong Kong. They say, we need 50,000 of these shirts made, and then that guy in Hong Kong goes out and gets bids from factories and says, you know, how long will it take you to make these shirts, and what's the quality that you can give us, and what's the price that you can give us? And he maybe hires 5 or 6 factories to make, you know, 8 or 10,000 each, and then those factories have to get all their what they call inputs, you know, the fabric and the buttons and the, you know, zippers and things like that, and then it's, you know, shipped and sold to consumers. And so I think Scott really referred to this as like this kind of interdependency that we all have on each other.
Yeah. Well, speaking of interconnectedness, as consumers, what's our role in the story of Fugitive Denim?
Well, it's both big and small, actually. That's a really good question. You know, as you said a few minutes ago, everybody wears jeans. I mean, they're the great equalizer in terms of garments, you know. You have wealthy people, you have poor people, you have, you know, they cross political lines and economic lines, and so everybody buys them. I think where consumers come in is that number that is reflected on the price tag is not always an accurate number of a price that's been paid. What I mean is, if you're buying $29 jeans, there's almost a sure chance, I mean, I can say with utter confidence, that someone somewhere down that supply chain line is paying a price for you to get jeans that are that cheap. So whether that means they're working overtime, whether that means they're, you know, they've had to send their kids home with extended family to be cared for, whether that means they're actually toiling away in a sweatshop or under, you know, slave labor conditions or child labor conditions, $29 jeans have a much larger social price tag.
Yeah. How many pairs of jeans do we own, Americans?
Well, the average woman owns 8 pairs of jeans now, which was just shocking to me. I thought that's more than there are days in the week. You know, we have washers and dryers. Most people, I'm sure, do a load of laundry at least once a week. Like, we really, really don't need that many. They, yeah. You know, what do we do to get them that dirty that they have to be? It's amazing to me. And what's also amazing to me is that we are paying the same amount for a pair of jeans in real dollars, not always, but generally, that we paid in, you know, 1979, 1980. $30 for a pair of jeans in 1980, not adjusted for inflation. So we don't realize just how very cheap our clothing has become for us. And now we think it's our right to have cheap clothing.
If there was a label, maybe there is, or maybe it's in the works, we have Fair Trade Coffee. If there was a label that could be sewn on a pair of blue jeans that would say Fair Trade Jeans, what would the price tag be for that pair of jeans, given that it was just, you know, just kind of your nothing fancy?
Nothing fancy. Well, that I would be totally, completely guessing, because it depends on where it's made, how far it has to travel. So you might have Fair Trade jeans from Mexico sold in the U.S. that would be less expensive than Fair Trade jeans from Sri Lanka, because they don't have to travel so far. And there are lots of other things, too, depending on who designs them and stuff. But I would say, my guess is that they would probably be somewhere around, you know, $60 to $80, something like that. But that's from a journalist's standpoint and not not someone who sets these kind of prices and looks at these kinds of things very closely.
Yeah. Do you think there will come a day when we see that kind of labeling?
You know, I do. Well, first of all, I do think that there are definitely there's websites you can buy what they call fair trade clothing or fair trade bags or recycled kind of things. And so there are some sort of underground movements happening with that already. But I think that it mirrors what's happening with our food, in that there's this real movement for us to become more aware of the origins of our food and where things come from. And I believe that the next obvious place to go in terms of that movement is with our clothing. You know, there's been a lot of interest on how things are made, where they're made, what chemicals are used in them, what we're putting on our children, and things like that. So it does seem to me to be of growing awareness amongst consumers.
Yeah, that was really shocking to me to learn all the pesticides and all the chemicals that go into making our blue jeans.
Yeah, you and me both. I had no idea. 3/4 of a pound of chemicals are used to make every pair of jeans in the manufacturing and producing. It was shocking. The problem is not so much with the consumers who buy that end product. We don't have too much to worry about, although if we're buying really cheap clothing, then there's a good chance that there's some
residue
left over from those chemicals. But you know, the problem is that those chemicals leach into the environment, into water, into, you know, groundwater and, you know, rivers or whatever, because there's a lot of water used in the production and manufacture of garments in general. And of course, the people who are working around that stuff are put at risk if they don't have safety mechanisms. And, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners visit the developing world, if ever, but, I mean, these are people where there aren't, they live where there aren't really safety conditions. They wear flip-flops to work. They wear, you know, and they wear flip-flops even on construction sites, you know. So they're not going to have all those sort of, you know, safety paraphernalia that we would require if they were all made in the U.S., for example.
Yeah, yeah. So is organic cotton the answer?
Well, organic cotton is one answer. It's the beginning of an answer, I think. There are issues. Some people say that organic cotton takes much more water. Organic cotton also requires more land, because you have to plant other crops around it to sort of attract the bugs that would otherwise eat the cotton. So it's not a panacea. It's not a perfect system, but it helps. The you know, the thing is, it takes 3 years for a field to be able to be certified organic when it's gone from conventional to organic. So it takes a little while. And right now, the supplies are not meeting demand. Actually, demand is growing by, I don't know, something like, you know, 400 or 4,000% per year. But also, the other problem is you take a pair of jeans that's made from organic cotton, and you still have to dye those jeans, and you still have to set the dye and do all the, you know, neat little color washes and tears and scrapes and things that we see in our jeans today. And throughout that entire process, chemicals are used. So you'll have organic, but it's a bit of a misnomer to think that that's a perfect kind of, you know, system.
What about
or a perfect kind of answer, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. What about the chemicals used to dye denim? Are safer chemicals on the horizon?
Well, there were, I mean, dye started from vegetables. So vegetable dyes, of course, you can't get much more organic. And there are people who try to use vegetable dyes, but they don't have, first of all, there's not a lot of consistency. And brands like to have consistency in their products. And consumers like a lot of color choice, and there are not too many color choices with vegetable dyes. So I think there's always new technologies out there. I think that our what really matters is how we treat the water after the dye is in it, and some of those systems I think need improvement.
What happened to indigo?
Well, it just can't. I say in my book, and I can't quite remember the statistic, but the amount of indigo, natural indigo, needed to dye, you know, a single pair of jeans or a single ton of jeans even, is just enormous. You would never be able to grow enough indigo to you know, meet the demands for denim around the world, not to mention all the other things that are dyed, all our other garments that are dyed. So that's not really a viable option anymore. It's still used. It's still used in North Vietnam, uses it. Japan uses it in some of their higher-end denim. And there's, I think it's Nigeria, has a sort of large tourist, you know, area that attracts people because it's, you know, they do traditional indigo dyeing there. And so it exists in pockets, but the world is only so big.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Rachel Louise Snyder. She is the author of Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, where is the cotton for all these blue jeans that we're buying and wearing grown?
Goodness, all over the world. There's a lot of cotton grown in the U.S., of course, you know, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California. Africa grows a lot of cotton. China grows cotton. Turkey is the biggest grower of organic cotton. India grows cotton. The former Soviet Republic, Uzbekistan, and Azerbaijan, and countries like that all grow cotton. It's grown all over the place.
And it moves back and forth. That's really interesting, isn't it?
It does. It does. It's amazing. You'll have cotton grown in Mexico, and then maybe sent to Honduras, where it's spun into fabric, and then, you know, it might get cut and sewn in Honduras as well, but then sent up to Los Angeles to be dyed. There's a lot of what they call them laundries, where they do the dyeing and the sort of treatment of denim. There's a lot of those in L.A. still. So they do. They get sent all over the world.
Yeah. Now, here in the U.S., the harvest of cotton is mechanized, and it's interesting to learn that that's a relatively recent advance. Of course, elsewhere in the world, a lot of cotton is harvested by hand. Maybe you would tell us about the Azeri woman you talked with and picked cotton with.
Yeah, that was. I had fun talking to her, but not a fun day picking cotton. Let me tell you, her name was Ganira. She was really interesting. She was in her early 30s, and she had just aged significantly. I mean, I thought she was in her late 40s when I met her. And they just tie a sack around their waist, and they walk up and down these rows of cotton, picking cotton balls. They call them balls, B-O-L-L-S. And it's incredibly drying on your hands. The balls, as they grow out of the cotton, grow out of a kind of spindly shell. So they, you know, they're sharp, and they prick you, and it's hot, and the sun is beating down on you, and it's extremely unpleasant work. And, of course, the more tired you get as the day goes on, the heavier your bag gets. So it just is drudgery. It's really just drudgery. I can't wish that as a job on anybody, really.
Yeah, and so much of it is picked by hand.
So much of it, and almost all women, actually. All over Africa, the people who pick cotton are women as well. And that was really surprising to me. I didn't expect that. I just assumed. I guess in the United States, you know, our field workers tend to be men, and I just assumed they were men around the world, but that's really not so. And it's done like this. It's done like this in India. It's done like this in Turkey and Uzbekistan and Africa. It's done like this everywhere.
Yeah. Now, how long had Ganira been picking cotton when you met her?
Gosh, you know, a long time, something like 18 years. I can't quite remember off the top of my head because it's been a few years now, but it was a long, long time. She started young. She didn't get, you know, much education at all, and she came from a family of manual field laborers. I mean, all the women in her family, her, you know, in-laws, female in-laws, all worked in the same cotton field, and you know, and she would say things like, well, we don't want men in the field. This is when we can finally talk amongst ourselves. So I think there is some, and I think she was right. I mean, I went back to her house after the day I spent picking with them, and it was like they were much more active and talkative and chatty and laughing in the fields than they were at home. At home, they were very subdued and very quiet. But, you know, what a high price to pay for a little social time, you know?
Yeah. What's her life like at home?
Well, I didn't spend a lot of time with her because I spent more time with other people. But, you know, her father is, when I was there, he was extremely ill and laying in bed all day, just sort of waiting. I think he was just kind of waiting to die. And he'd worked in cotton fields driving and doing other work, planting and doing some other things. So you know, quite possible that he may have gotten sick from the pesticides. I don't know. That's my own diagnosis. But, you know, it's like she's like any other woman in a developing country. She serves the men in the house, and she's very quiet, and she's not married herself, doesn't have children, so she takes care of her nieces and nephews, and, you know, they sleep in, you know, lots of people in one big room in a, you know, it's a decent house. It's a wooden house on stilts, fairly large, but, you know, extremely poor, sort of one light bulb for electricity, you know, one table with four chairs. They eat in shifts because so many of them live there. You know, she lives in a house with about a dozen people, with her parents and her brother and his family and sister and her family.
The people that you met along the way in researching the book, Fugitive Denim, has their standard of living improved as a result of the work that they're doing, the toil that they do?
Well, I can speak mostly about Cambodia because that's where I still live there, of course. And I would say unequivocally, yes, in Cambodia, that's certainly true. The garment workers, there are about 300,000, and then there's another million or so people who live, you know, have subsidiary businesses based on the garment workers. Like they sell, you know, vegetables or rice or clothing or whatever right around the factories, or they rent their houses or things like that. And, you know, they really are sort of the rising middle class. Their salaries average, the average salary for a garment worker in Cambodia is about $71 a month, which doesn't sound like much until you learn that teachers and police officers make $25 a month. So, you know, it's much better to be a factory worker. And also the labor rights that were written in when Cambodia made this deal with the U.S. to try to eradicate sweatshops actually only apply to the garment workers. So if you are a teacher or a police officer or a construction worker, you don't have the rights that garment workers have. You know, they have the right to unionize, they have vacation, they have health care, they have... they're still working in factories. I mean, I wouldn't want to work in a factory. It's still unpleasant work as far as you know, my experience mm-hmm. goes. But they've got a much better deal than a lot of their fellow citizens.
Yeah. What are working conditions like in a factory in Cambodia?
Well, most of them don't have air conditioning. Of course, most Cambodian homes don't have air conditioning. It gets extremely hot there. So, and then you add textiles on top of that, and they are hot. They have to have good ventilation, high ceilings, and, you know, fans or open windows or things like that. But, you know, they all still felt really hot to me. But, you know, they have decent electricity. They've got decent bathrooms. Every factory is required to have a small clinic, a healthcare clinic staffed, you know, depending on the size, staffed either just by a nurse or by a doctor and a couple of nurses if they're a bigger factory. And they work, you know, they work regular hours, 7 to 4, something like that, with a lunch break. And they're really, they're not bad places, you know, and they get paid for overtime. When they do work overtime, it's usually 2 hours a day overtime. It's supposed to be voluntary. It, you know, it may or may not be. That's kind of a point of contention often. They work, the minimum wage is $50 a month for a 48-hour work week. So they all work. Saturdays are a regular work day for everyone in the country, not just for garment workers. So, you know, they're not bad. They're not sweatshops.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about chemicals. I'm wondering about brown lung, and is that a problem in the manufacturer? You know, where does that enter the picture, and how big a problem is that in the year 2008?
Brown lung disease. Well, mostly that comes, that doesn't happen quite so much in garment factories. It's more in cotton gin.
Right.
Where that would happen. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know that it's even, I don't know that there's even awareness about, I think bisonosis is the actual term for it, but I might be mispronouncing that. I'm not sure that there's actually awareness about that even, because the cotton gins that I went in, and they were only in Azerbaijan, had huge ceilings, but nobody was wearing, for the most part, nobody was wearing, certainly no one was wearing masks. Some people had handkerchiefs over their faces, but I don't know how good that, you know, those are in terms of their efficacy. So I think it's a huge problem, but I think it's a little like diabetes in the third world, where it's a huge problem, but it's undiagnosed in 98% of the cases.
Interesting to learn that was the disease that led to the creation of OSHA.
Yeah, I didn't know that either until I found it in my research. So, yeah.
And that's just in the 1970s. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that we in the United States have, you know, we have a lot more money, so we are able to do things like fund medical research into brown lung, the causes of brown lung disease and things like that. And we are then able to manufacture equipment to combat some of that, or medicine to combat some of that, or treatments. And, you know, most countries in the world do not have that luxury.
Another person you met in Azerbaijan was a fellow by the name of Mekmen Hüseyinov. I hope I've pronounced it correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
He's passionate about cotton.
He loves cotton.
Yeah.
He was really great fun. That's one of the things about my book, I have to say, is that we're talking about all these kind of really heavy topics, but the book is written, I meant for the book to read like a novel. Like, it really is about these people who are, you know, funny and fun and worried about their future and concerned about their families and really just a lot like people in America, you know? And Mekmen, who knew that there was a person in the world as passionate about cotton as he was? But he was, and he would feel people's shirts and be able to say, not 100% cotton, and it would be, you know, like 95% or something. It was amazing. He really, he knew cotton inside and out. I mean, he was almost like a musician who's been playing the piano for all of his life, you know, where he could sort of just play blindfolded, and he understands, you know, what notes fit together to make a sort of beautiful sound. It was cotton. Mechman was like that in, you know, walking through cotton gins or testing cotton or just even talking about it. You know, he just knew it inside and out. And he was young.
Yeah. How many grades of cotton are there, and how does he do what he does?
Gosh, you know, I do talk about this in my book. I think there are 5 grades with just about 1 million variations on each of them. But he'll take a sample of cotton from a, you know, you pick the cotton in the field, and then it goes to a gin where the seeds are taken out, and it's it goes through a number of steps and ends up in a big square, you know, sort of tied together ball of cotton. And he takes samples, you know, a handful from one or two of these for each crop, one or two of these, you know, the end product from a cotton gin, and then from a cotton farm, sorry. And then he brings them to his lab, and he looks at the length of each staple. So he'll look at the length of a cotton fiber, and the longer the fiber is, the higher the quality of the cotton. And he also looks at basically the diameter. I mean, it's, you know, one piece of cotton lint is thinner than a piece of hair, so he's really looking at minutia. And those are the two main ways that he also looks at color and consistency, and he'll smell it and things like that. But that's how he grades cotton, and then based on his grade, that's what the price will be for that certain cotton. So if it's a lower quality cotton, the farmer will get less money on the open market, but also then it will be made to, it'll be sent to be made into jeans or things like that. Jeans are, generally speaking, not high-quality cotton. They're usually one of the lowest or the lowest kind of cotton is used in jeans, and in fact, the very, very lowest quality of cotton is used in medical supplies. So.
Yeah. And he refers to himself as a metro-modern, right?
Yeah.
And he is a really interesting fellow.
Retro-modern, he was. Because he had these kind of conservative, he was sort of socially conservative. You know, he was Muslim. He didn't he didn't practice. You know, he couldn't, for example, pray 5 times a day because he works in an office and he works with people who are not Muslim, and so he doesn't pray 5 times a day. But he does observe things like not drinking and not you know, he doesn't really date too much. He's going to someday find a woman and marry her, but there won't be a long courtship involved in that, and his parents will be involved in that somewhat too. And he was involved in helping to approve the husbands of his sisters, which I really had to keep my mouth shut about. I couldn't believe that. But he also, you know, he dresses nice, he goes out dancing, he is really into capitalistic ideas, and he loves sort of modern urban society, cafes and jazz and cheesecake. You know, he's always talking about cheesecake and cappuccino, like these are the benchmarks of an urban sophisticated society. And if only Baku, Azerbaijan had more of these, then, you know, they would be a world-class city.
Well, there's a lot to be said for cheesecake, right?
Boy, you know, I said to him, can't you get in a few places? We should go test some, you know?
Well, also, you ran into some people who are passionate about cotton and about denim and about fashion in Italy.
Oh, of course, yeah. Fashion and food, right?
Right.
To the Italian. Yeah. I talked to Pascal and his wife, who are denim designers, which is a step I didn't even realize existed. I didn't even know there was such a job. But they design fabric, and then that fabric is what actual clothing designers that we are familiar with or that we know about, they choose those fabrics and you know, make various kinds of garments out of them. So Pascal would come up with, you know, maybe 18 different new kinds of denim each year, something like that. And they would have different finishes and different washes. Some would be darker, some would be lighter, some would have a little tint in them. And it was fascinating to hear them talk about denim because they just spoke in these, like, beautiful, poetic terms about how versatile it was and how it changed as you wore it to reflect your own, you know, your own lifestyle. And I just thought, Wow, I had never thought about a garment in that same way. But I mean, you know, it's sort of true. Someone who sits at their desk all day in a pair of jeans for years on end is going to have much different, you know, a much different sort of footprint on those jeans than someone who is, I don't know, working out on a farm, you know, and mm-hmm. really putting them through the ringer, as it were. Sorry for the. It was really hard to get away from, like, similes while I was writing this book.
Well, fashion and food, what kind of things did you eat with Adriana and Pascal?
Boy, you know, I wish I could say we just had great Italian food, but we were up in Bergamo, outside of Bergamo in the north of Italy, and this is really an industrial part of Italy. This is not a place where tourists generally ever go. And of course we're actually a half hour outside of Bergamo, so we're in a small town and it's just trucks and industry. I mean, people are always telling me how much they love Italy, and I just think, sure, you love Venice, you love Florence, mm-hmm. But you have not been a half hour outside of Bergamo. <You know? laughs> we ate microwave pasta in Italy. It was appalling, really appalling. But I had a couple of nice meals, and in fact, one night they had me over for dinner, and they cooked, and it was wonderful, just a risotto, but it was, you know, lovely, lovely. Yeah, so, yeah.
Well, it's just another way, though. It shows us another way how we can relate to someone half a world away, whether it's, you know, Ganira trying to, you know, get out of the house and talk with her friends, or, you know, these two people in Italy resorting to microwave pasta, you know?
You know, it's really true. And I think a lot of that came out of my desire to be able to communicate with my own family in a way. Like, you know, my family, they're not really travelers for the most part. They don't have passports. They haven't really left the U.S. And here's their daughter living in Cambodia, you know. I found the first year that I was there, my husband and I just found that, like, I could never explain what it was like there or what life could be like. And so in some ways my book isn't really about genes at all. It's just about other people's lives around the world, you know. It's just this kind of picture that you get, a little tiny picture of how somebody else lives. And I wanted to write a book because, you know, my family is never going to read a book on globalization. They don't travel. They're not interested in it. They don't really have a concept of it. And so, but you know what? They will read a book about people. Mm. So that's really what I was trying to do. So, you know, it's a funny book, I think. It's engaging and it's, yeah, more like a novel in a way. Just happens to be true.
Yeah. Somebody, who is it here? I have a blurb, as they say, here in front of me. A rare book that is neither boring nor preachy, but a wise tale of what global trade really means. From Elizabeth Becker.
Oh, yes, yes, Elizabeth Becker. I was going to say, whoever said that, that was so nice.
Well, I'd say she hit it on the head.
Well, thank you. That is really what I was trying to do. I don't. People always ask me, in particular when I go to readings, like, "Oh, Walmart." You know, they bring up Walmart all the time, the evils of Walmart. And I say to them, like, I come from a family of Walmart shoppers. I don't shop at Walmart because I don't. Well, because I live in Asia, first of all. So I live in Cambodia, and there aren't any there. But also, I can afford a little bit more, so I tend to shop at maybe a little bit higher end place, and I don't buy as much. I don't buy things en masse. But I think that they serve a necessary role, actually, in our country today. There are people who are really hurting financially. And, you know, I have certain members of my family that don't have a lot of money. I am not going to tell them where they should and shouldn't shop. I'm not going to tell them that they shouldn't shop at Walmart, you know.
Yeah. Well, in the epilogue, you raise a really good issue. You say, you know, what really concerns you in regards to Walmart and other discount retailers is how these mega chains, quote, incite our overconsumption.
Yes, that is of greater concern to me. I'm not so bothered with people who want to shop at a Walmart or, you know, Sears or something like that, as with people who just buy stuff that they don't need. Again, we're back to the eight pairs of jeans. I mean, who needs eight pairs of jeans? And even if you only actually need two, I can understand going beyond two and saying, but I want three or I want four, but eight, you know? And what's amazing is when you sort of, I'm going to use a simile again, when you unravel it, you think, gosh, we have so many more clothes now. And look at all the new houses that are being built, the new houses that are being built with these massive gargantuan closets, massive gargantuan storage spaces, because we have so much stuff. And it became even clearer to me when I moved halfway around the world, because when we travel back and forth a lot, and we really have to pare down the essentials. And for me, that doesn't exist so much in clothes as in books. You know, I had to limit myself when we moved there to 40 books, and that was just painstaking. Oh, it was so painful. But I think it was a really great learning experience for me, and that's the amazing thing about, you know, I'm actually 7 months pregnant right now as I talk to you.
Yeah.
And so my husband and I have all these conversations because we, you know, we're going to have the baby in Bangkok, and then we'll spend the first year of her life in Cambodia. And so we have people giving us all these, like, gorgeous, cute little baby clothes, and I love them. They're adorable, but they're not necessary. We don't need them, you know, and it's really, it's just, I don't know, it's depressing to me to I guess, come back here sometimes and just see how much stuff there is.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Well, even people in large homes with one or two children, I think they're grappling with all the stuff that they have. And, you know, even in a in a house with, you know, adequate closets, whatever that is, I'm not quite sure. But it all depends on, what you know, your who you are and what you think about that issue. But I think that people struggle with that here.
They do. I had a heated discussion with a relative of mine recently because we're not buying a stroller for our baby. And he insisted that we would just be so sorry that we, how can you have a baby without a stroller? You're going to be so sorry. And I said, there's no sidewalks as such in Cambodia. They're, you know, the sidewalks that exist are ad hoc. So they're, one will be 12 inches high and the next one will be 6 inches high and the next house won't have any. So, you know, I'm not going to stroll my baby along the street. And he couldn't understand that, you know, even the definition of need and want is so different these days, you know. He couldn't understand that we didn't need it. We also don't have a crib, you know. I mean, there's just sort of basic things that people think of as needs that probably, if you really think about it, are more like conveniences.
Yeah. Well, if that's the question that you leave people with who've read Fugitive Denim, do I need this? You've probably done them a great service.
Well, that's my hope. Someone, you know, I get asked the question a lot, what do you hope
mm-hmm.
for this book? And I think I had someone at a reading tell me, oh, yeah, when I walk past shop windows, I always sort of stop and see if I can read the label. And, you know, that's kind of enough for me. That to me is growing consumer awareness, you know, to ask those questions, to stop and look at the label, to stop and say to yourself, do I need this? You know, do I want this?
Hmm.
I mean, I don't know what it was like when you were a kid, but I don't remember having to buy an entire new season of clothes every year. We would get, you know, maybe two or three new school outfits, but we certainly wouldn't get, like, all new fall clothes because it's 2008 instead of 2007.
Well, I think I had one pair of jeans and I had one pair of, I'm remembering this from, you know, when you're in what they call now the tween years, I had this horrible pair of red corduroys. That was it. You know, we had a school uniform, so that wasn't an issue at all. So we had, you know, a couple of blouses and socks and underwear and that kind of thing. But the pants were just, you know, nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing. I remember my first pair of jeans clearly. It was really an event.
Yeah.
In my life. Yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
I know. My grandmother bought them for me. They were Vidal Sassoon.
Oh, what a wonderful grandmother.
I know. They were periwinkle.
Oh, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon. It's been a lot of fun, great pleasure. And the best to you and your family.
Well, thank you, Celeste. It's been fun for me, too.
Take care.
Thanks.
Rachel Louise Snyder is a journalist. She is the author of Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people in pants in the borderless world of global trade. The publisher is W.W. Norton.